Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Be excellent to each other, Chaos Kids. I'm Naomi.
I love that. I'm Amber. This is Crime, Wine, and Chaos. Yes, be. Always.
Be excellent. Yes, to each other.
Be excellent.
Hi, sister.
Hi, sister. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks. I'm really feeling like, I think one of the reasons why I decided to say that as the intro today is because I'm really feeling kind of the, I don't know, my humanity and I'm feeling the love right now. So
that's good.
It's amazing.
Yeah. You're back from DC.
I'm back safe from DC. Sound. Safe and sound. I got back last night. I'm still a little sore. Saturday was a long day, but it was epic, sister. It was epic. Ugh. It was, well, the estimate is 400,000 people marched, but I think it was way more than that who actually showed up. But what ended up happening is that the speakers were like on the stage. They had like 20 plus speakers and it went for like 3.5 hours of speaking. And I know just in our group, like more than half of us had to leave before the marching started to like get home. And we could tell by the way that the crowd was thinning a bit around us later in like, as time went on that like other people were leaving. So I think that before we marched, when we like the peak of that crowd was way more than 400,000 people.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. And we had, it was incredible. There was this amazing moment, Amber, where it was more than a moment. It was one of the times for the Muslim call to prayer. And they had a man on the stage with the microphone do the singing of the call to prayer. And all these people, like all of us, more than 400,000 people were absolutely silent in respect of the time for the call to prayer. Mm. You could hear a pin drop. It was amazing.
Oh, that gives me the chills.
It was so cool. Dr. Cornel West was one of the speakers. Claudia De La Cruz was a speaker. Jill Stein was a speaker. Plus a whole bunch of like Palestinians came up and spoke about their life and their family and what they're dealing with. And it was amazing. And then we walked all the way and the end of the march was right in front of the White House. And I have a picture of me and my buddies in like the darkness of DC with the White House lit up behind us with our keffiyehs on. It was incredible. I mean, this isn't even like the bullet points, but I could go on and on. It was amazing. I'm a better person for having been there. I've made a bunch of new friends. It's incredible. It was incredible.
Wow. That is incredible. Oh, fuck.
What about you? I heard it was really cold while I was gone.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's negative something in Seattle. And I don't even know how that's possible.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be possible.
You know, I feel like anything, it all pales in comparison to what you've done. So we'll circle back to me next week. In the meantime, we have a new Chaos Kid, Joe M. Welcome.
Joe, what is up?
Hey, Joe, what do you know? And this drops the day after Virtual Wine Night. So hopefully Joe is somebody that we get to meet. We'll have met yesterday.
That. Mm-hmm. I will love that. I would love that. Yeah. Yes. That sounds amazing. What are you drinking? I mean, Monday morning. It's a bank holiday, guys. We're recording the day after I got back from DC. We're both still kind of in pajamas. I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm existing in sweatpants all day. Thank you for asking. Yeah. I'm drinking one of these Celsius drinks. Have you ever had one of these?
No, I've heard of it though. They have like very, very high amounts of caffeine, right?
Fuck, I don't know.
Pretty sure.
I guess so. Great.
Pretty sure.
Well, it's pretty tasty. It's a dragon fruit. And that's what I'm drinking.
Great. I got my water per use. Great.
Per use. Good for you.
Per use. Sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a crime for me today?
I do. I'm going to take you on kind of a wild tale here. Are you ready? Buckle up.
I mean, I'm as ready as I'm going to be.
Okay, great. So I am going to tell you about the murder.
Murder.
Ravish Kumar, which by the way, there's somebody else like famous named Ravish Kumar, who's some sort of political person. And so when I was trying to find sources for this Ravish Kumar, it kept conflating the two. So
thanks, Google.
Thanks, Google. Let me tell you about this Ravish Kumar. So
great.
We are going to Monte Sereno, California, which is an elite community very close to Silicon Valley.
Okay.
Where many tech industry workers live. In November of 2012, a call comes in to 911 dispatch around 1 o'clock in the morning from a very frightened woman who says that she needs help. She says her and her husband are both tied up and she believes that her husband is dead.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. So within minutes, police and medics arrive at the 7,000 square foot home.
Whoa.
I know, right? Fuck.
Whoa.
Yeah. And inside they find two victims, 66-year-old Ravish Kumar, known as Ravi. He's tied up. He had tape around his eyes and over his mouth, and he was pronounced dead at the scene. And also in the home was Ronnie Kumar, who was Ravi's ex-wife, but the two still live together. She was found blindfolded and terrified. She's the one who made the call.
Okay. I'm already kind of suspicious of the wife. Sorry.
I know. Well, right? Right.
Yes. Yes.
So she tells police that earlier in the night, she went upstairs to her bedroom and Ravi stayed downstairs watching TV in the living room. And she said later in the night, a man came into her bedroom, forced her out of bed and into the kitchen, where she briefly saw Ravi struggling with other intruders. She said that they removed her jewelry and blindfolded her and tied her up, and they were searching the home for other valuables.
Mm-hmm.
You don't believe Ronnie right now?
I'm having a hard time.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. So investigators note that there's no blood at the scene, and Ravi doesn't have any obvious wounds. But an autopsy report later showed that he had died from asphyxiation from the duct tape around his face. And it was likely that the intruders didn't actually intend to kill him. Like, I think it was supposed to cover his mouth, but it covered his nose too.
Okay.
That's a bad way to go.
It's like there's not very many good ways to go, but that's, yeah.
Do you think that if you had enough wiggle room to like, you think that like your spit or something could loosen up? You know what I mean? Well, I'd be trying to like.
It depends on how much, like how many times is the tape wrapped or whatever. You know what I mean?
Oh, God. I know. It just sounds very close to like being buried alive or something. It just sounds
drowning.
Inducing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, God. So Ravi had come to the U.S. from India in 1970. He moved to Silicon Valley and helped start several cellular companies and later went on to be an angel investor, funding a whole bunch of new companies in the Valley.
Wow.
Yeah. It was also known that he had a very bad habit of never locking his doors because they lived in a safe, gated community. And in a gated estate. And so he didn't feel like it was necessary.
I mean, I get it.
I know you do. I don't. Jesus. God.
I mean, let's be real. Like, especially if you're home for like at night. It is so uncommon. It's so like improbable that someone's coming into your house. Mm-hmm. There aren't like bands of rogues like roaming all the neighborhoods in this country, like looking for houses to walk into. That's just not real, you know?
Right.
I get it. I get it.
Okay. Well, so they learned that $30,000 in cash and jewelry was taken.
Okay.
And Ravi also didn't have any security cameras in his home. And the only witness was his ex-wife, Ronnie.
In 2012?
Yeah.
He should have had cameras.
I know. He's a tech guy. I mean, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. So Ronnie she did get a good look at one of the attackers before she was blindfolded. She said one of the attackers was holding a cell phone that was lit up. And so because of that, it lit up his face in the dark and she was able to see him a little bit. And so she works with a sketch artist to, you know, do a composite sketch. Uh-huh. Investigators also find in the kitchen sink that it was filled with latex gloves that were obviously used by the intruders. They put them in the sink and then the sink was filled with soapy water in an attempt to destroy fingerprints or DNA.
Yep.
And they also found the empty roll of duct tape that was used to restrain Ravi and Ronnie.
Empty? That they used a lot of duct tape.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they did. So Ronnie and Ravi had been married for over 35 years. They had two adult children together, but Ravi also had other children with other women.
Oh.
Yeah. So when investigators dig into his private life, they learn that he had relationships with several different sex workers, some of which he had children with.
Wow. Okay. Mm. Okay.
He had supplied money, vehicles, and sometimes homes for these other women.
I mean, I'm starting to see why they are not married anymore, Ronnie.
Right. Like, that's a deal breaker for most people, I would imagine. Like,
mm-hmm. But, like, it sounds like she, like, put up with it for a really long time. They were together for 30-plus years or whatever. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't mention anything about her having a career. So it's like, also, what is she going to do? She's an immigrant here who's relying solely on her husband.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, it's complicated. So they also learned in talking with some people that knew him that he was, quote, intentionally spreading his seed because he was very impressed with himself and believed that his genes should be out in the world.
Fucking men.
What? I kind of hate it when the victim in your case is a fucking douche and you're like, okay, this person's dead. I want to be respectful of that. But are you kidding me right now?
Right.
What the fuck?
God.
Spreading his seed.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I have no comment.
Mm-mm. So one of these women was Katrina, who Ravi was particularly fond of. He met her in 1999. At the time, she was 19 years old. He went on to have a relationship with her for 12 years. And over that time, he had given her hundreds of thousands of dollars, gifts and cars and all kinds of things to help support her lifestyle.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
We're like in full like sugar daddy mode here.
Exactly. I don't think Katrina was one of the women that had one of his babies. He was just one of the women that he was particularly fond of.
Just one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Robbie.
Yep. Yep. So police talked to Katrina thinking that she would know that his house wasn't locked and she may also know where Ravi and Ronnie kept their valuables, but she said she didn't know anything about this.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the soapy gloves. Unfortunately, that plan didn't work. And the investigators were able to collect DNA from the gloves and from the duct tape.
Oh.
Yeah. They were able to get two different samples of DNA. And when they put it through the database, they get matches on both.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. For D'Angelo Austin and Javier Garcia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So both of these...
I'm still suspicious of Ronnie. Can I make a prediction?
Sure.
I'm happy to be wrong, but maybe Ronnie hired these guys.
Okay. All right.
Just a thought. Just a thought. Look, I'm in, you know what? This is where my mind goes.
Everything is a conspiracy or?
Well, no, it's not that. It's just that so often in these situations, it's the partner. I mean, more often than not, it's like, you know, obviously the husband did it or whatever, but like in this situation, anyway, it's just so, so more likely that the partner is the one. But anyway, mm-hmm. Keep going. I'm okay. On the edge of my seat.
Okay, so D'Angelo Austin, Javier Garcia. Both of these men were members of a local gang known as Ghost Town.
Okay. This story is wild. You're right.
I know. And they were also members of a sub gang or like an offshoot of Ghost Town called Money Team. This is like a really weird family tree.
This reminds me, there was another story we covered. I can't remember which one of us did it. There was some other story we covered where it was like, it was you. There was like a, I think there was like a gang and they were called like the Moneymakers. It was the gal whose story inspired Candyman.
Ew. Yes.
Remember the gang? What they were
at Cabrini Green Housing.
Money Masters or something. They're the master something, right? Remember? Yes, and I was like, it sounds like a Cash App.
Yes. Oh, well, here's another Cash App, the Money Team.
The Money Team.
The Money Team.
Okay.
So the Money Team was all about committing home invasions on wealthy people.
Okay.
And Javier Garcia does resemble the composite sketch quite a bit. But investigators also found a third DNA under Ravi's fingernails.
Uh-huh.
And that DNA belonged to Lucas Anderson.
Okay.
So Lucas Anderson was in the database because several years prior, he was convicted of a home invasion robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also able to establish the location of D'Angelo Austin and Javier Garcia based on cell phone records, but not of this Lucas Anderson guy. And they also learned that Javier was Katrina's brother. Yep.
Nope. Don't know anything about it.
Uh-huh. So all four were arrested for capital murder, but investigators are very confused when they learn that Lucas Anderson had an airtight alibi. And not only that, but he didn't know these people at all. He had no connection to them. He didn't know them at all. He was an unhoused person with pretty significant mental health issues and no links at all to fucking Money Tree or whatever and Ghost Town DJs and whatever. Wasn't that a group, the Ghost Town DJs?
I don't know.
Remember that song of the 90s? Come on, ride the train and ride it.
I remember the song, but I don't remember who it's by. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So Lucas Anderson was raised by a single mother who was also unhoused. He had suffered a traumatic brain injury after stepping off of a curb when he was drunk and getting hit by a car.
Oh,
I know. When he is confronted with the DNA evidence, specifically that his DNA was under the victim's fingernails, he says he has no idea what they are talking about. But because he has such severe memory issues, he's starting to doubt himself.
Oh, no.
I know. And because DNA evidence is so reliable, he starts really believing that maybe he did it and he just doesn't remember.
Oh, no.
I know. His public defender, who this woman is a badass, his public defender said, quote, "This is a very sophisticated crime, and Lucas is not the kind of guy you take with you to do a sophisticated crime."
Right.
Oh. So she gets to work trying to establish Lucas's whereabouts on the night of the murder. This is not easy because he's unhoused, right?
Right.
He's a heavy drinker, but luckily he doesn't stray from like a 12 block area in San Jose, which is about 10 miles from the Ravi's house.
Mm-hmm.
And he has several friends from the streets who know him well and sort of look out for him. Like he was pretty harmless and people just knew like he just kind of existed around that area.
Right.
And his attorney learns that on the night of the murder, Lucas had interacted with law enforcement at a local grocery store because he was extremely intoxicated and panhandling outside of the store. He went into the store and was so intoxicated that he collapsed and the employees called 911.
Oh.
Uh-huh. His blood alcohol level was 5 times the legal limit.
Jesus.
I know. So he was taken to Santa Clara Valley Hospital, and hospital records showed that he was admitted at 10:45 p.m. and he wasn't released from the hospital until 9 the following morning. This is the night of the murder.
Oh, so he was fully alibied.
And he had 10-minute bed checks the entire night because he was dangerously intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. This is crazy. His DNA is under Robbie's fingernails, though. Sister.
Yeah. Yep. So they are fucking baffled at how in the world it's under Robbie's fingernails.
So am I.
Mm-hmm. So they first consider that maybe because Lucas doesn't have any ID or anything, that maybe somebody else who looked like him was admitted to the hospital and it wasn't him. But they talked to several staff from the hospital that night and they're like, no, it's for sure Z's was him. So then they go back to the DNA evidence thinking that maybe there was contamination at the lab, and they do a full investigation of the lab and there is no contamination. So Corporal Aaron Lunsford is determined to figure out how in the world this happened. So he starts looking through hospital records from the night of the murder, which was the same night that Lucas also got picked up at the supermarket. And he learns that the two medics who responded to Lucas at the grocery store were the same two medics that responded to the home invasion at Robbie's house just a few hours later.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. And they believe that what happened was that the little pulse detector that you clamp on a person's finger.
Yes.
The same one was used on Lucas that they then put on Robbie.
Stop it. And it left DNA under Robbie's fingernail?
Yes.
That's crazy pants.
I know. Whoo. Yeah. So Cynthia Kale, who she's a badass. She conducted the first study in the U.S. on the phenomenon of secondary DNA transfer. So direct transfer obviously is a person either touches something and their DNA is just on there, or they like cough or sneeze on it. Secondary is transferring it from one person to an object onto another person. And so she says this is actually really easy to have happen. And a lot of people think that DNA is like such a foolproof science that there's no way it could be wrong, but.
Right. And like, this is the thing, like when people say like DNA is not foolproof, this is what they're talking about. Not that like identifying somebody with the DNA is not foolproof, because that is, but this kind of stuff happens. And this is what makes evidence not foolproof.
Correct. So it was that pulse oximeter that wasn't sanitized when the medics went from one call to the next. And there it is.
I hope that this led them to a new protocol.
I know. Well, I don't know. So luckily Lucas is released. Poor guy.
I know.
Can you imagine?
No. Like,
and the only time I would ever say it was lucky that he was so intoxicated and taken to a hospital.
Right?
Right? I mean, what the fuck?
Although had he not been, then he never would have been in that mess in the first place.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. His DNA wouldn't have been there.
Right. Right.
Okay. So as for the other three, Katrina admitted that she did make it known to the other two dudes that Robbie had valuables in his unlocked home. She even provided her brother with a map of the inside of the house. It's like you're already being taken care of fully by this guy for 12 years. Like, why?
Also, apologies to Ronnie. I take it all back.
Yeah. Well, it's also like, you know, I'm sure that Ronnie is financially well and fine, but she was very traumatized and because of her husband thinking he needs to fucking spread his seed everywhere.
God.
I can't, dude. Anyway, Katrina took a plea deal and spent 4 years in prison. Mm-hmm. Javier Garcia was given 37 years to life, and D'Angelo Austin was given life without the possibility of parole. And a third man, Marcella Strummer, was also linked to the crime and was given life without parole.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The DNA expert Cynthia Kale says that if DNA is the only evidence, that should give you pause. She strongly believes that if Lucas Anderson hadn't gone to the hospital that night, or hadn't, if the hospital hadn't kept such good records, he would definitely be sitting on death row right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Forensic Files.
Yay, Forensic Files. Yay, good forensic job. Files. Sister, that was incredible. I was like, that was a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
God.
Yeah, stop DNA. Spreading your seed. If DNA is your only evidence, then you're not doing well, then police aren't really doing their jobs, because that can't be all the evidence that you have. They can't. Mm-mm.
No. Well, and kudos to the public defender. Most public defenders are just going to kind of, no offense to them, but their caseload is too much.
Well, and a lot of them, like, that's how they start out, but that's not where they want to be. I mean, it's those ones that they are really passionate about the job, you know,
they
really take it seriously. Like, yeah.
Yeah. She really dug deep for him.
Well, thank goodness for that. Mm-hmm. She gets extra humanity points in my book. Mm-hmm. Plus 5, as Joshua would say. Yes, I have some chaos for you, sister.
Tell me.
We're going to go to Walt Disney World.
Oh, going to Florida.
Back to Florida, kids.
All right.
The epicenter of chaos. So, Walt Disney World is located just outside of Orlando, Florida. It first opened to the public in 1971. It was 12 years earlier in 1959 that Walt Disney Productions had begun looking for land where they could build a second resort to supplement Disneyland in Anaheim, California, which had opened in 1955. Market surveys at the time revealed that only 5% of Disneyland's visitors came from east of the Mississippi River, where at the time, 75% of the population of the United States lived.
Okay.
Also, Walt Disney disliked the businesses that had sprung up around Disneyland and wanted more control over a larger area of land in his next project.
Okay.
Let's not forget, side note, because, you know, it matters. Walt Disney was a well-known anti-Semite and staunch supporter of the Nazi party. Just cool, in case cool, we cool. didn't, because we haven't done this in a while, to bring it back to Nazis.
Cool.
And because Walt Disney was nothing if not a shrewd businessman, in order to make sure they got the most land for the least amount of money, the company actually purchased various parcels of land all contiguous with each other using different dummy companies.
What?
Yeah. So in total, Disney bought 27,443 acres, or roughly 43 square miles of land. There were tracts of flatlands, cattle lands, and then a whole bunch of these like smaller 2-acre plots that had been sold to investors back in 1912 that turned out to be useless to them because most of them were swampland. So those folks were happy to sell their 2-acre parcels off to Disney.
Right.
So working strictly in secrecy, real estate agents, unaware of their clients' identity, began making offers to landowners in parts of Southwest Orange and Northwest Osceola counties. The agents were careful not to reveal the extent of their intentions, and they were able to negotiate numerous land contracts with some landowners, including large tracts of land for as little as $100 an acre.
Shit.
Knowing that the recording of the first deeds would trigger intense public scrutiny, Disney delayed the filing of paperwork until a large portion of the land was under contract.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, they're like quietly buying up all this land in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Walt Disney himself would actually die of lung cancer in December of 1966, 5 years before Disney World would be completed and open to the public. His brother Roy postponed his own retirement to make sure it was finished after Walt died.
I guess I didn't know that he passed away before that opened.
Mm-hmm. So Roy would successfully argue to the state of Florida that Disney's property would need to be declared its own district with its own cities incorporated inside that district, Bay Lake and Reedy Creek, which is now Lake Buena Vista. Mm-hmm. He also got the governor and the state Supreme Court to agree that the only areas where this district and these cities would be subject to the county and state would be property taxes and elevator inspections, and the district would have full immunity from any current or future land use laws.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. The fuck?
So basically, Disney the corporation bought 43 square miles of Florida land and then got themselves their own district with two cities and made themselves exempt from any larger governmental interference trying to tell them what they can and cannot do with the land they bought.
Wow. Wow.
And they have. Since then, Disney World has gone from one theme park, Magic Kingdom, and a couple of resorts to four theme parks. And I couldn't even count all the resorts and attractions at this point.
Jesus Christ.
One area in particular, an island in the middle of Bay Lake near Magic Kingdom, named by Disney as Discovery Island, welcomed guests for 25 years. Only 3 years after Disney World opened in 1974, what was then called Treasure Island had its first visitors. The original theme of Treasure Island was based off the Disney film of the same name and had a wrecked ship visible on its shore. The name was changed to Discovery Island 4 years later. The island was essentially a nature preserve only accessible by boat. Have you ever been to Disney World?
No.
Mm-mm. I've been once. It was a really long time ago. Ironically, I was just talking about this the other night with my friends. It is like you drive in on this highway to get into like to get to the entrance of like Disney World. And then once you get to the entrance of Disney World and you like pay, you have to like pay per theme park. This mm-hmm. This was like the 90s that I went. So I don't know what it's like now, but I can't imagine it's much different. So you pay per theme park, like for a day pass. So you have like Magic Kingdom, you get a day pass for Magic Kingdom. Like that's the theme park you can go to, but they have like four theme parks now. So like Epcot Center is a whole other theme park within the property. Then you get on like a train that like takes you out there, or you get on a boat that like takes you to a place, like, cause it's like this huge, anyway, it's
wow.
vast, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this island, Discovery Island, had 140 species of animals and 250 species of tropical plants. Disney leaned into these facts and dedicated the island as a nature preserve. After purchasing tickets, tourists would board a ferry from the Magic Kingdom Park and sail for the main dock on Discovery Island. Once they made it past the ticket collector, the first thing they saw was the Thirsty Perch, the park's snack bar. And there they could grab light refreshments like sodas and slushies and various other snacks.
Okay.
Once past the Thirsty Perch, visitors explored the trails that wound through the island. Along the way, they would see Monkey Colony, where capuchin monkeys perched in the trees, Flamingo Lagoon, where flamingos meandered in the water, and Avian Way, arguably the park's most popular attraction. Avian Way featured a large boardwalk suspended above the lagoon where people could walk through the enclosed area and see birds from all over the world. In fact, I read somewhere in here in one of my travels that the avian area was one of the largest enclosed avian areas like in the world.
Shit. Okay. I had no idea that this existed there.
Right. Discovery Island also featured live shows or animal encounters where guests learned more about the park's animals. One such show was the Discovery Island Bird Show, where the audience watched a lighthearted demonstration featuring macaws that could talk and roll over. Another show was Reptile Relations, where the host displayed reptiles like alligators and snakes.
Ugh.
But then in 1998, Disney World added Animal Kingdom, a fourth theme park on their massive property, and no one really cared about going to Discovery Island anymore, so it was getting no traffic, and they shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, left alone, nature took back over. They didn't do anything with the island, so all the buildings and structures just went abandoned and got reclaimed by the natural Florida environment.
Uh-oh.
And then the rumors started.
Ooh.
In the 20 or so years since Discovery Island closed down, Disney has never issued an official statement regarding its closing. And although the reason is straightforward, the lack of closure has given rise to many theories for the island's abandonment. Theories like brain-eating bacteria in the water or government involvement are a couple of them.
brain-eating bacterias in the water?
I mean, Amber, it's the internet.
Ew. Okay.
You know, we've talked about like the theories that circle on the internet, right?
Yeah.
Ugh. The internet's fascination with the island was further fueled by urban explorers who trekked to the location and documented their findings. Some of their discoveries are slightly unnerving, from experiencing several alligators stare back from the darkness to the electricity still running and lights turning on even though no one is there.
I hate this.
What's also eerie is that many of the buildings and exhibits still exist years after their abandonment. The Thirsty Perch stands today in a state of ruin, with even the soda machine still inside.
Okay, I'm sorry, real quick. First off, that's gross. Second off, are there animals there that are supposed to be cared for that are just ditched?
I don't know what happened to the animals. I can't imagine they just left animals like in cages and like didn't take care of them. Maybe they moved them to Animal Kingdom.
Okay. Ooh, okay.
The Avian Way boardwalk is slowly collapsing as time goes by, while it's taken over by plants and worn down by the elements.
Ugh.
So despite Disney banning anyone who trespasses on the island, some people continue to sneak there to explore. Some even camp overnight on location. A YouTube video by Bright Sun Films gives an incredible overview of the footage of an urban explorer caught during his exploration.
How are they getting there?
By boat, secretly. Because that's the only way to get there is by boat.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads us to spring of 2020.
Okay.
We all remember that time when the COVID pandemic really hit and lockdowns became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And YouTuber Richard McGuire, whose channel is Southern Pirate Outdoors, decided in April of 2020 to travel from his home in Alabama to Florida to go camping on Discovery Island.
Oh, God.
Richard's YouTube channel is a combination of exploring abandoned places and him like wrestling giant snapping turtles and shit. I'm not totally sure what his deal is. Also, he refers to himself as Rip Thorn.
Okay. I feel like Jade watches this guy.
Maybe. And apparently when he took a boat out to Discovery Island to camp out there and explore, he got caught on a security camera because Disney does not allow anyone on that island.
Mm-hmm.
Richard had traveled to the island around 11 p.m. on April 29th and was spotted on the camera around 7 a.m. the next morning. And that's when the police mobilized to get him off that island.
Mm-hmm.
According to the footage Richard took while evading the police in what they called a manhunt, he lost 20 pounds in 4 days on his, quote, mission, as he called it.
What?
But it looks like he was only out there for like 2 days.
Okay.
So he filmed himself while he's hiding from police on this island over the course of these, whether it's 2 or 4 days, I think it's 2 days, but he claimed 4. I don't know. The lake where this island sits, Bay Lake, is full of alligators, and the police confiscated his boat. Some of his footage is of him slowly walking in an area of the island where you could hear the sheriff's office talking to him through a bullhorn saying, "We will not arrest you. We have your boat." And they're telling him that he's trespassing on private property. And then he cuts to another scene of him walking on a path through the trees with like dramatic music. And then he turns the camera onto himself and he whispers, "They'll never catch me."
Oh, God. You're on an island with a boat.
Like, the drama he adds to this whole video cannot be overstated, Amber. The music, the things he says. At one point, he's all, "I walk in spurts. I walk maybe 15 feet. Then I stop and listen. I can barely talk right now. I'm so tired, but I ain't giving up."
Oh, God.
At some point, he talks about how it rained for 3 hours. He's soaking wet, and these cops are out here trying to track him down for trespassing. And then he wants to know, what is really going on, Disney? What's really going on this island that you're trying to hide? He says, quote, "There's something up they don't want people to know about. I don't know what, but I'm here to find out."
Wow.
The police did have their guns drawn while they were searching for this guy. And Richard saw that, which made him very indignant.
Yeah.
And it also fueled that paranoia, right? Like, they're out here with guns on a manhunt. What are they trying to hide?
Like, it's Area 51.
Yes! Yes!
Oh, my God.
I found an article that had police body cam footage that had been released to, like, the news outlet that reported on this. And it says more than a dozen Orange County sheriff's deputies, quote, swarmed the island trying to locate a trespasser.
Jesus.
The newscaster called it, like, harrowing footage or something, you know?
What in the world? Oh, God.
There's other footage from Richard of him, like, covering himself up in leaves to hide from the helicopter that's circling to try and find him. And he says, like, the video's camera, because I think it's like a GoPro, and you can see the angle of the camera is like his own perspective. So all you can see is like half of his body from the perspective of like you looking down at your own body laying down. And he's like trying to throw leaves on top of himself. And he goes, you can hear the helicopter above. And he says, Disney World ain't playing. Disney World ain't fucking playing. What? So about 12 hours later, he talks to the camera because he's constantly like turning the camera like up to his face. You get this weird view of him like in the camera, right? And he's talking about the dangers of trying to swim away from the island after realizing that they took his boat. And like he's wearing black and gray camo clothing, like head to toe, and like a black beanie. And he's talking quietly to his camera about the cops that he is actively eluding and his escape plan and the alligators. And it's all very serious. At one point, he goes down to the shoreline near where he's hiding and he starts collecting empty plastic water bottles to pull together something for a flotation device.
Oh, he's going to build a raft out of garbage?
Well... sort of. So he pans the camera up while he's searching the beach to show the lake and the shore on the other side. And he says, that's a long swim. They'll never expect me to swim off the island that way. And at one point he finds a water bottle that's still like half full and says how thirsty he is because he's only had water off of leaves that day. And he says, I don't care. And he films himself drinking this water.
Oh, God. He's
fighting for his survival, Amber.
Oh, God. Couldn't he get an old soda from the Thirst Hutch or whatever the hell it's called?
the Thirsty Perch.
Oh, yeah.
next, he films himself searching a persimmon tree for any of the fruit that's ripe enough that he can eat. And when he finds one, he whispers, thank you, Lord. And he starts like eating this persimmon that he's just picked off this tree.
Oh, God.
Then he shoves all these empty water bottles he's collected into his backpack to make it a flotation device, and he jumps into the water.
Oh, that's pretty smart.
He must be using like a waterproof GoPro or something because we can see this all happening from his perspective, and he goes underwater and he has a small knife in his hand, like he's ready to grapple with an alligator.
Mm-hmm.
And he's swimming his way back to the mainland.
How far is this to the mainland?
I'm not 100% certain. It's pretty far.
Oh, God.
Scary. So his backpack starts taking on water and it becomes pretty useless for floating. And then it cuts to like an hour later. He claims in his video like it's been an hour and he makes it to land and the sun is down now. So it's totally dark. He's like breathing heavy and sputtering water and shit. And you can hardly see anything because of how dark it is. And next he's filming himself on a phone call with his girlfriend, and she's telling him that the police found her in their van, the one that had hauled the boat, and they picked her up, and he has to go turn himself in or they're taking her to jail.
What?
Yeah, but then the police footage shows Richard coming to shore in a boat where he is arrested on the spot. So I'm not sure he actually made that swim that he claimed to make.
It doesn't sound like it.
Right?
Oh, my God.
He says to one of the officers, I'm just wore out, flat wore out. And then the deputy asked him, did you go camping? And Richard said, yeah, that's a tropical paradise. I was going to stay out there for about a week.
What the hell? So,
anyway, Richard eventually entered a plea deal of no contest in exchange for a $100 fine. And he received a lifetime ban from Disney World. I'm not sure if that extends to all the Disney locations, though.
What
at the time that, at the time that all this went down, his YouTube channel had like 2,000 followers. Today, he has over 12,000. And his footage of evading the cops on that island has over 50,000 views. And Richard continues to explore abandoned places. It seems that's what his YouTube channel is for.
I'm wore out. Wow. Oh, my God.
I seem to recall, I couldn't find it in any of the articles that I ended up pulling up, but I swear that at one point I read something about him thinking or someone thinking that there was like government experiments going on Discovery Island. And that's why it was, you know, off limits. And the police were so, you know, serious about tracking this trespasser down and getting him off the island.
That's fucking hilarious. I love that so much. Oh my God. Oh, I'm going to watch that.
You should.
Oh God. Fucking so Florida, good. Man.
Well, this guy's from Alabama, just for the record. I don't want to. Florida probably doesn't want. I mean, maybe Florida would want to claim him, but technically, he's not a Florida man. He's an Alabama man.
Gotcha. I love everything about that. Thank you for that.
You're so welcome, sister.
Shit. Oh.
Well, sis, we made it.
We made it.
We did it. Another one in the can. I love you.
I love you. It sure was.
Everybody, go follow us on all the things.
Mm-hmm. Sign up for our Patreon. Become a Chaos Kid Club member so that you can catch the next virtual wine night and get all of the bonus episodes and behind the paywall shows.
All that stuff. Patreon.com/crimewineandchaos. You can find us at crimewineandchaos.com. You can email us at crimewineandchaos@gmail.com. Amber reads the love letters. I read the hate mail. We respond to all of it because we love it. Do. Oh, hey, if you're on an Apple device, go into that podcast app and write us a review. Tell everybody what you think.
Hell yeah. I mean,
you know, if it's going to be nice. We do love it. We do love it. Yeah. Honest feedback, always welcome.
For sure.
Sister, that was fucking chaotic.
Fucking chaotic. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Wine and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers. Let me bring my story to my other screen because I don't like how this is looking. All right. Great.